Welcome back to another episode of On Life and Being Human. I'm your host, Catherine Colleen, and today we are going to put ourselves out there on a limb and we're going to talk about religion. I want to talk about what it's good for and how it can really help you, and it can be a wonderful thing, but as we all know, it can also be problematic. So what we're going to talk about today is both sides, the good side and the bad side. We're going to talk about religious discomfort, religious rejection, and we're also going to talk about the false pursuit of asking religion to tell us how to live our daily lives. This is going to piss off some people, I'm sure. That's okay. I want to talk about it really honestly, because we can't really fully be honest with ourselves if we can't think about the roles that religion plays in our lives. We have to be able to think about what religion is to us and our histories with religion individually, as individuals. And as part of your self-inquiry, you cannot leave this subject out. And if you're in stage 7, you will really appreciate this because you're into rejecting everything. So you're going to be like, yeah, reject religion, sure. And it's an important step, actually. If you want to become closer to your faith, you have to step away from it. I know that sounds ironic, but most things I find in the universe are that way. So let's start with the bias that I'm bringing to it here, which is I was raised without religion, technically. So the two sides of my family, my mom's side and my dad's side, were wildly different in terms of their interpretations of religion. And so my parents decided to raise us without religion. So I say technically because whenever we would visit one grandparent or the other, my sister and I, not my parents, would attend church with that grandparent. So if we went to see my mom's mom, we would go to church with her. If we go to see my dad's mom, we would go to church with her. Funny enough, my parents did not consistently join us, and I don't blame them. So one side, my mom's side, was Methodist, and that can mean a lot of things. And the other side was Southern Baptist, and that is very narrow kind of thing. And I could not fathom how the same book, the exact same book, literally King James Version of the Bible, could be interpreted in two such opposite ways. And let me explain. So when we would go to my mom's side of the family, go to the Methodist church, it was bright, it was joyful, it was appreciative. And as long as you gave your tithe, as long as you gave your 10% money to the church, you could do just about anything you wanted, as long as it wasn't specifically against the Ten Commandments. And then, of course, one would have to ask for forgiveness. But the other side was dark, and it was full of certainty. So the Southern Baptist side was full of certainty that regardless of what good you had done or what bad you had not done, you were an evil sinner and you are sure to burn in hell. You are ultimately unworthy of God's love. And I could not put these two together. I didn't get it. As a kid, I was very confused. Because on the one side, it was joy and love and gratitude and appreciation. Isn't everything beautiful? And aren't you loved by your deity? And on the other side, it was just so dark. And you're just a horrible, horrible person. And it was very hard to understand. So along with that, I saw a lot of hypocrisy. I saw preaching love and caring for your neighbor, but in the words and in actions outside of church, those same people could be so spiteful and negative and hateful. And sometimes even within the same sermon, you would get talking about loving your neighbor or talking about wanting to to do good in the world, and at the same time talking about how horrible some people are. So it's very, very confusing. So that was my history. It was almost a sort of preemptive rejection, which gave me some space to step away from it and try to get a grip on what's going on there. So it was a great place to examine it from. It's a great place to look at the trees from outside the forest. So even today, I look across the world and I see religion used to justify acts of hate, acts of love, and anything in between. And here's the thing that it comes down to. Anything you can think of can be justified and equally can be condemned by your religion. I don't care which religion you've got. It doesn't matter if you're Christian. It doesn't matter if you're Protestant, if you're Catholic, if you're Jewish. It doesn't matter if you are Muslim, if you are Buddhist. And you say, what? No, really. The other day, I saw an article about Buddhist monks on the other side of the world loudly advocating violence against a particular group of people in the same city. And I thought, what the hell? Buddhists? Come on. This is a massively peaceful religion. I actually went back through the Dhammapada, which, if you're not familiar with this, is a fantastic read. There are tons and tons of books out there on Buddhism, but the Dhammapada, you look for the spelling of it in the article on this same subject. The Dhammapada is what is believed to be the original teachings of the Buddha. And it seems really, really clearly against violence to me, but their justification was, under the auspices of kill or be killed, what do you do? So they were being threatened, and therefore these monks chose to threaten right back. You could take a look at that as an example, and they didn't cite their religion specifically to justify it. It was more of their existence on the planet and the issue of kill or be killed. But it's something that would clearly go against the teachings that they're supposed to embody as monks. Crazy. And I mean, this is said really well. Jay-Z, also known as Sean Carter, has this awesome lyric. They say, an eye for an eye, we both lose our sight. And two wrongs don't make a right. But when you've been wronged and you know all along that it's just one life, at what point does one fight? And it is a good question. On the other hand, they're Buddhist, so I guess they have many lives. I don't know. Anyway, religion is a form of ideology. And along with social and political beliefs, it forms the ideology that we in stage five use to define ourselves. Now, the point of having an ideology is to help us prioritize our needs above, below, and among the needs of others. It may be family first, and then fellow churchgoers, and then never mind those liberals, and so on. So you all get this all big rolled up ideology, which includes religion, among other things. Now, we use our ideology more to justify how we prioritize our needs and the needs of others, rather than using our ideology to tell us what to do, if you watch. So if you watch people, you will notice they're not using their ideology to tell them what to do. They are using their ideology to justify what they are doing. And then that feels very good, right? Because we like to think that we are adhering to our ideology. So there's a question. There's your first question for you today. Do you use your ideology to justify how you treat others? Or could you use it instead to give you some foundational principles? Good question. So overall, the ideology just exists to justify how we behave. Now, you can argue that many religious texts do tell you how to behave properly, but I can show you how the same text suggests the opposite, or at least justifies it. And that's why I can tend to feel some discomfort and periodic rejection of religion. This is just me. But at the same time, I'm drawn to the comforting idea that maybe somewhere in these many, many books of wisdom are all the answers. And they are there, for sure, buried under layers of historical context. But if you can recognize and excuse the historical context for what it is, you can see the truth at the heart of each of them, and it is the same. Have you found it? It's worth an exercise that I undertook when I was 13. I guess that bears a little bit of explanation. Because I was raised without religion, when I turned 13, I was allowed to choose my religion. I did not have to choose a religion, but I was allowed to then explore and choose if I wanted. Well, I was voraciously waiting for this day. And when I turned 13, I read every religious text I could get my hands on. Every one of them. The Bible, the Quran, the Dhammapada, the Tao Te Ching, every single one. I read stuff from Baha'i, from Sikhism, from Jainism, from some of the Hindu. That is tough reading. That is tough, even in English. But I voraciously devoured these religious texts. And I approached them like an anthropological study. But what I noticed was the big picture. And I found some level of dissatisfaction in each of them, but I found some level of truth in each of them and wisdom in each of them, once you kind of filtered out the historical context. There are, all the answers are there. So if you found it, let me know. So religion can be a phenomenal catalyst for your self-development. If you have a religion and you're working your way around the cycle, trying to spend more and more time in the later stages, remember, it is a cycle. You're going to get pulled back around it many, many times over and over. So do I. But your faith, you'd be amazed how close you can get to your faith. That although there's a stage of rejection in stage 7, there's a stage of true intimacy with your faith, true connection with your faith that comes later in stages 8 through 11. If you really want to get to know your deity, work your way around this cycle. But you've got to question things in stage 7 in order to make that happen. And as we've talked about before, questioning your religion, even stepping back from it for a while, is not, in my opinion, blasphemous. In my opinion, it is a necessary step in order to become closer to it. It's very similar to the way children grow up. When they get to their late teens, early 20s, they have to break the relationship with their parents and reform it as a new relationship. They have to get distance and then come back and reform more of a peer-to-peer relationship, right? They have to break the parent-child relationship, this sense of authority, and recreate a relationship that is much more peer-to-peer. And you found, I'm sure you have, when you do that, you end up with a relationship that is much closer, with a connection that is much deeper. It is no different with your deity. It is absolutely no different. But you've got to break that relationship to come back as to a relationship that is much more deeply connected. So let's talk with the other major problem around religion, which is asking our spiritual or religious ideologies to help to tell us how to live. And this is why we tend to use our ideologies to justify what we do instead of tell us what to do. And you're like, but wait, my religion has all these rules about how we live our lives. It's true, they do, most of them based on historical context, but some of them may be actually extraordinarily good for you. So, for example, there are certain religions that fast for at least one day, or maybe just one day per week. That is so good for you. The research is coming out right now about how amazing this is for you. So fasting, it turns out to be pretty good for you. But religions can dictate for you absolutely anything you want. So let's talk about this. So as our perspective on our true nature evolves, that perspective is also an ideology. It's a spiritual ideology. It's sometimes a religious ideology. And in each stage, we leave behind the need to define our current self in a certain way. So for example, you go from I am my needs to I have needs, but they are not me. I am my ideology. And then you go away from I am, you know, you no longer define yourself based on your ideology. But eventually we arrive at there is no self. And when you really get that, when you really internalize that, it is enormously liberating. But all the while, we still must, from a point of survival, have a self. But we understand that the self is not us. So we get to a point where we have needs, we have an ideology, and we have a self, but they are not us. And even this perspective is an ideology in and of itself. You know, where does it end? Well, it doesn't end. That's the good news and the bad news. So as our perspective evolves, it's natural then that it can have significant implications for the rest of your ideology, for your moral ideology, the way you treat others, the way you treat animals. It may have implications for your political ideology. And so on, for your social ideology. Now, while we understand that we can have an ideology, and we can evolve that ideology, and that ideology is not us, our new spiritual ideology is likely to evolve our moral and political ideologies, and that brings significant risk of becoming stuck in the stage of I am my ideology. Do you see how that pulls you right back around again? Because every time we evolve or improve our ideologies, just based on our experiences and our reading and such, we get very proud of what we figured out. And we can tend to be really defensive about it. You know, I figured out that there is no self, and I'm going to sit here and defend that fact, right? And there I am right back in stage five again, defending an ideology, even if my ideology is that I am not my ideology. I'm not my ideology, damn it, and I will defend that, right? So it's, whenever you're thinking about ideology, even it gets easy, very, very easy to get pulled back into stage five or six. So we can identify much too closely with it. Now, understand that we must be careful to not get trapped in stages five and six, which is the I am my ideology stages. But let's consider the possible implications of a stage 10 or 11 perspective. And I was dealing with this the other day. So follow me on an absolutely ridiculous thought exercise, right? Recognize this is ridiculous, but follow me, because I want to show you how ideologies end up in a place where Buddhist monks are advocating violence against specific groups of people. So try this. So if I am the one consciousness and the physical manifestation, and there is no difference, then there's no difference between me and anything else. I am one with everything. This should bring me to a beautiful state. You know, me, my loved ones, random strangers, people I don't particularly like are all me, or extensions of me, or reflections of me. And for that matter, all that means that the animals and the trees and the furniture and the air and the sky and the stars and the planets and the microbes are all me. Well, I know I shouldn't hurt myself. I should love myself and I should be kind to myself. Well, therefore, I shouldn't hurt anyone or anything or any animal or any tree or any object or any plant, because that would be hurting me. Therefore, I should not harm, kill, or eat anything. Then I will starve, which is harming myself. Well, what if I only eat what is produced by plants and animals, but does not require that the plant or animal has to die? Right, I could eat nuts and seeds and certain fruits and veggies and things like that. What if I did that? Oh, but sometimes the animals are treated badly and I shouldn't support that. So I'll have to know where my food is coming from, and I'll have to make sure that the animals are treated kindly, right? And so if I'm going down this road, then I'm going down a thou shalt not kill road, which takes on a much bigger meaning at this point during these stages. So to be consistent, I have to value all life, human or not, born or unborn, plant, furniture, inanimate objects, everything. Or I could see that death is a natural part of life and that my energy is returning to me, so no harm done. What about burning wood for fire? Maybe that's okay if the tree's already dead, or is it returning the energy back to the universe? You see how this can get really, really confusing. So if the whole of existence is rather miraculous and every part of it should be protected, or am I saying that every part of it should be returned to the energy? So holy crap, could you use the same exact ideology to defend mass murder and global annihilation? We need to return everything and everyone to the energy. Do you see how you can use the same exact concept to justify absolutely anything? So it begs the larger question. Is it wrong or is it beneficial to release from the physical and return to the energy? The only thing I'm certain of is that I don't know, and I absolutely do not want to advocate violence or killing of any kind. Absolutely not. But the only thing I know is that I don't know. And at the heart of all of this is, why do we always look to our spiritual ideologies to tell us how to live day to day? We're desperate to live our lives correctly, whatever that means. But there are as many different definitions of what that means as there are people. And as you can see, you can use any ideology to justify anything. Take your favorite religious text. Whatever you want to justify, I can show you something in there that will justify it. It gets a lot harder to find that in the Dhammapada or the original books of Sikhism or Jainism. However, apparently, according to this particular set of monks, you can. So here's an even bigger question. Why do we want to be told how to live? Telling others how to live is just a form of defending an ideology or a belief system. Feeling insecure in your own choices, you must defend them by pushing them on everybody else. Now, no one wants others to tell them how to live or what they can or cannot do. But we look to our religion or our ever-evolving moral codes and our ever-evolving spiritual concepts to guide us in what to do or not do. We're still children trying to do right, whatever that means. So the danger in setting your daily life according to something that is continually evolving is that you will never be certain about what is right, because what is right is always changing. There is no right. And worse, the same exact religious text can be used to justify absolutely anything. So, okay, maybe defining right is too much of a gray area. Could we define wrong? There are a few widely held ideas about what is wrong, such as it is wrong to kill people, at least. Even those are open to interpretation. For example, if somebody's trying to kill you, you are in the right to kill them first. Or if you ask ISIS or Che Guevara, it's right to kill people of alternate sexualities and certain other groups of people simply for existing. Most Buddhists would say it's wrong to kill or injure or be aggressive in any way towards your fellow person. But a specific group of Buddhist monks in Asia is currently advocating violence towards a specific Muslim sect nearby. So again, the same books and writings are being used to demonize or justify the same exact acts. And with that, I can really see why monks generally keep to themselves, because it's an impossible series of questions. So when you look to your ideology, no matter what stage you're in, when you look to your ideology to tell you how to live, remember that what you're really doing, honestly, is looking to your ideology to justify how you're choosing to live right now. Because your ideology, you can read anything into it. Anything. And so this is another reason why we can tend to reject religion, or feel at least uncomfortable about our religions, is because of this, the inconsistencies, the cracks, the way that you can read anything into it, that can be really uncomfortable. But if you look at the kernel of them, if you look past the historical context and you look at the wisdom that's in it, what is in it that is timeless, what is in there that's true, and you read all of the different religious texts and you see what is the same in all of them, you will see a great wisdom that is true all the time. And we're always kind of looking for that certainty to latch on to, I think. We're always kind of hoping for something that we can really keep a hold of. And it's in there. I'm telling you, it's in there. But be aware that as your ideology evolves, you may reach a point where you want to look at your now closer relationship with your deity, or your closer relationship with your faith, and say, what does this mean for my day-to-day life? How should I live my day-to-day life? And the answer is, it doesn't really matter. It really doesn't. Because however you choose, you can justify it from whatever book you're choosing to look at. So live the way that you feel compelled to live. That being said, there's a lot of great wisdom in thou shalt not kill. And I hope that the monks who were feeling the need to advocate that will get to a place where they can see that they have been pulled into probably stage three. I am my needs, because their need to survive, their need to live this current life, has far exceeded anything else and has put some distance between them and the values that they are attempting to study and attempting to espouse. All right. So that being said, I've got a great, great audience question here, and it's about, how do I know what stage I'm in? Because I seem to be in several of them all at the same time. And this is a really fantastic question. So how do you know what stage you're in, right? The question itself comes from our general need to give ourselves a grade and mark ourselves as existing in one particular box. And this thinking of self-development as a staircase of achievement. and it's not. So it's a cycle. We develop through these 11 distinct stages. Distinct. They're a little fuzzy on the borders. We go through these 11 stages and we go through them over and over and over and over and over for our entire lives. I'm willing to bet that even the Dalai Lama finds himself back in stage 2 or 3 at some point and then has some mindfulness to say, okay, wait. So the way I would approach trying to figure out what stage you are in is to think about it on a daily basis, right? So each day, at the end of each day, think to yourself, what are the stages that I experienced today? And how many hours did I stay in each stage? And you'll find that you may have had a small amount of time that you were in stage 3 or 4, kind of more focused on your needs. You may have had a little bit of time where you were listening to a political talk show and it made you really focused on your ideology, or you went to church and got really focused on your ideology. But you may have had more time where you were sitting there just kind of questioning things, thinking about everything, questioning everything. So you may have spent the majority of your day in stage 7. Which is, I reject all ideologies. But you may have had small amounts of your day in stages 3 or 5. You could have a day where you roll through every freaking stage in the cycle. That's a very chaotic day. I hope you don't go through that. But you may have a day where you seem to move very smoothly through stages 8 through 11, kind of ramping up to this beautiful moment of feeling the oneness. Those are nice days to have. So we are never really in just one stage. It's just, where did I spend the most of my time today? And be really honest with yourself about this, right? When you're on a journey of self-inquiry, you have to be brutally honest with yourself. How are you spending your time? What are you feeling? Honestly, why are you feeling it? And the reason to take stock daily, if you're new to this, of which stages you are spending most of your time in, is because what gets measured gets managed, right? Drucker never goes out of style. If you are remaining cognizant, and you know at the end of the day, you're going to look back and try to think about which stages you were in today. You're going to make a conscious effort to move yourself through these stages and to spend as much time in stages, say, 8 through 11 as possible. And that is the point of keeping track of it. So great question. Answer being, we're never just in one stage. And any one day, we may spend most of our time in one particular stage or another. So that's how I would look at it. It's fuzzy, I know. It's not exactly the staircase or the grading scheme that we might prefer. But that's how it works, right? Life is fuzzy. Life is messy. That's how it goes. All right, thanks for joining us here today. If you have questions, you can send them in to questions@koabd.com. That's questions@koabd.com. And I work them into the end of each podcast. So thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.